Let's see. All right, here we go. I believe I have this device working. I'm in the B folder for Bolton.
Well, remember to tell Jay where I am.
Okay.
Which page you want us to look at?
Here's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to take on one Mishnah that we have not done before. And though it's going to be related topically to the captives issue, I think you'll see that it's really about, not about freeing slaves, it's about redeeming captives. Pidyon Shvuim. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And redeeming captives is a major topic heading in the life of the Jewish people. If you look throughout our history, it has been something that the Jewish community has contended with from time immemorial, for sure in the time of the great conquests of Alexander and of Rome. Of course, you had people taken away in the age of the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and who knows what kind of redemption we could see there. We don't necessarily have those records, but we do have Talmudic passages about it. We have records of receipts in the Cairo Geniza. And we have records of receipts there that instead of 33, let's say whatever the currency was at the time, they would pay 40. You have all kinds of taking of captives, Middle Ages, Age of Enlightenment, all kinds of reality that Jewish people were plucked from their communities to serve in the Russian army. The communities that had some infighting would convince the authorities to take people, and then there would be Jews who have to redeem their leaders. They knew that it would happen, the redemption would happen, because this redemption of captives is such a strong part of our tradition, who we are. The Rambam codified it as being an essential mitzvah, quoting the Gemara. And thus, in all subsequent Jewish law codes, it is a mitzvah, aseh, it's a positive mitzvah, one must go do this. And there are different kinds of categories, even, that people fall into, status categories. Is the person Talmid Chacham? Is the person a sage? Is the person the wife of someone else? Is the person just a community member? Is the person a fellow from your town? All these kinds of questions come about when it comes to redeeming these folks because of, in some part, the Mishnah that we're about to learn together, where in terms of this being a locus of the whole matter, in terms of the redemption itself, we get a law concerning the ransoming of captives, paying ransom for captives. And of course it comes within this chapter because there's a whole element here of Tikkun Olam. And since we're searching for the roots of Tikkun Olam and we're searching for the meaning of that phrase as well, what we're going to see tonight is perhaps another aspect of Tikkun Olam that we have not encountered heretofore. That there's an element of Tikkun Olam here where it actually puts what might benefit one person in the context of the greater community, and therefore we might not, quote-unquote, save that one world. We might not save that one person. It might be that we have to take the consideration of the entire community into account versus what might be good for one single individual. Now, that's not the basic tenor of what we've seen before, right? We want to make sure that one woman gets her get. We want to make sure that the slave we were discussing knows full well his status and even achieves as close to freedom as can be. I would say that's the trope of the Gemara. This Mishnah comes dealing with redeeming captives, dealing with Tikkun Olam in a little bit of a different way. And we're even going to see that maybe Tikkun Olam isn't the real issue here, because even though Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel is the one to promote this idea of Tikkun Olam, maybe he has a different solution, even in terms of legal terminology, for what's really going on here. Maybe it's not Tikkun Olam. Maybe it's some other type of Tikkun that we need to make. Okay, so that's the background for where we are on page 45A3, if you're using the Gemara, the Schottenstein. We are on Daf Mem Hey Aleph at the Mishnah that begins Ein Podin. So 45A3, Mishnah Ein Podin. Okay, Mukhanim? Ready? Here we go. So the Mishnah says the following. Ein podin et ha-shivuyin yater al kedei demehen. One may not ransom captives for more than their value. How do I find the value of someone in the ancient world? I go to the slave market. Well, it's not exactly what you paid for them. It's exactly what would be paid for them on the slave market right now. Now, what's interesting here, does it say slaves that are held captive? No. So we have to note that. Even though we were in a lot of discussions about slaves and their masters and avadim, the Mishnah does not deal with the continuing saga of the avadim who are taken by these bands of people. The simple term is hashvuyin. So we don't really know if we're reading a little bit like a narrative in terms of the perek, in terms of the chapter. We don't really know if it only meant the avadim. Of course, what I'm going to tell you now is it doesn't only mean the avadim. It's a word that we have to take into account that could mean your Eved is held captive, but the frameworks of the stories we're going to see in the Gemara surely does not limit it to people who are in some other kind of status, meaning other than Jewish. It's inclusive of Jews in our family and in our community. It might even be beginning with the woman who is taken captive and held by others for ransom. And because we know the Gemara's stories in the other places where shivuyin, where captives are mentioned, don't limit it to just women and wives, you can translate this word as being much broader. So, you don't ransom them for more than their value. Mipnei tikkun ha'olam. For the benefit of the world, for the benefit of society, for the legal principle that we've been grappling with, for fixing laws within the community that work to keep us what?
Us.
To keep us, to keep us safe, to keep us applying the law in the best way we know how to benefit the members of our society. Right? So as we think about Tikkun Olam and this kind of practice of refining the law, we're really refining the law for members of our community. That's Tikkun Olam.
Functionality.
So the society can function, and for the betterment the benefit or the betterment of society. Okay. A related law comes in the Mishnah. V'ein mavrichin et ha-shivuyin, and you can't assist a captive to escape. Now, what's a mavriach in modern Hebrew?
Smuggler.
A smuggler. So you can't go and smuggle somebody out of their cell, out of their jail.
Why not?
Oh, why not? Because what? Mivnei tikkun ha'olam. For the benefit of society. Just tell me how, right off the bat, without looking at the Gemara, without looking forward, how does it benefit society if I don't help a captive escape from his prison?
Because those people who capture those people, if we will steal some of Lavriach, some of them, the next people that they will capture, they will put them in a position that we will not be able to do that, and then it will cage them, even make them torture.
Okay, that's what Rashi is going to tell us. It's exactly what Rashi is going to tell us. Good. Maybe he's an advanced student like that. Rashi's not going to say it on the Mishnah in his Perush, but he's going to actually deal with it a little bit later on. And he's going to deal with it in the context of the issue when there's the question of, are we dealing with just one captive? Or are we dealing with many captives over there in jail? A bunch of people in prison? Or a bunch of people not there yet? But we're talking about a situation where we're talking about one person versus many people. He's not talking necessarily about the future captives. A little bit different here. Are we talking about one person who's in captivity? Or a bunch? We'll get to that. But here's the interesting piece in the Mishnah. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer. Now, how do we know Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel already? Right? You remember who he is?
He's the one who gave the prosbul.
That was Hillel who gave the prosbul.
Hillel or Gamliel?
Shimon ben Gamliel is the son of Rabban Gamliel the Elder, and he's the one at the beginning of our chapter who created the whole beginnings of what we're reading about in terms of Tikkun Olam. So Rabban Shimon Shelo Yehu Osin Kein Mivnei Tikkun Olam, in terms of the convening of a court and the going to the Beit Din to make sure that the get is going to be kosher in the end. The point is that he, at the beginning of the chapter, is mentioned through the fact that his father is the first one, and then he's involved in the up-and-coming Mishnayot in our chapter, Shimon ben Gamliel, about Tikkun Olam and the establishment of Tikkun Olam. And then, over here, he says the following. Maybe it's not Tikkun Olam at all. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Mipnei Tikkun HaShivuyin, or Takanat HaShivuyin. Maybe the prohibition was enacted for the benefit of any captives who are left behind. Because he wants to see it as being particular to that situation. But what do I mean, the interesting part mishnaically, is he wants to immediately say, wait a minute, you thought that was Tikkun Olam? I have a different term for what's going on here. Takanat HaShvuyim. It's a fix, a takana, for the captives themselves. So we're going to try to understand what that means in terms of it being a fix for the captives, but what we're saying is that you wanted to apply in the Mishnah of the reasoning, Tikkun Olam, but I want to tell you that it falls under the category of a little bit of a different reasoning. And we're going to ask ourselves, why does he push it to have just a kind of a different name? Or a different kind of specific hesper, a different kind of specific explanation.
So it's more particular?
Yeah, so that it becomes more particular. Maybe he sees this whole area of law with shivuyin, with captives, as being really an area of law that needs to be fleshed out entirely. Maybe he's thinking that with captives' laws, we really need to establish this area of law in a deeper way. And I'm going to name this area of law Takanat Shivuyim, and I want us to press this envelope here in terms of the legal reasoning behind it. Because if a Gamliel speaks, or a Shimon ben Gamliel speaks, and I can establish an area of law. Arthur, doesn't it work like sometimes like this in the court system? Where if I have a certain area of law that's going to be established, like immigration law, when we had on the West Coast, right, the famous constitutional law cases of the West Coast and the new immigrants building the railroads and panning for gold. Was immigration law a thing before that?
Probably not. I don't know. I really don't.
Seems to me in the history of law, you get to a certain place and you get court cases that come along and then open up. You know, criminal law can even work the same way. Within criminal law, Miranda versus Arizona. Right? So within criminal law, if I have the beginnings of the Miranda rights and what rights I have to talk to my, you know, perps and those who are being arrested, allowed the guarantee of certain rights when someone's going to be arrested by the authorities.
Yes.
Whole new area of law. And then I have to go and say, well, that's for the rights of, read them as rights, right? Really? Before that, did we have anybody saying there's a category of law in criminal law that you have to inform or read the rights?
I see what your point is, yeah.
And so then
it was right.
Right. And then there's a whole set of discussions and a whole set of cases, and this one challenges it, and this one challenges it. How do you say it, and what do you say? So it's just for the perps, that law, instead of just being general criminal law reform.
That's true, only for people who are arrested. Yes.
Yeah. So sometimes you can get very specific within legal categories and legal reasoning and those with a certain status. And I think Shimon ben Gamliel is on to that, saying for these people, this particular status, I want a very different set of legal reasoning to come to light here. So I'm already going to tell you that don't apply this tikkun olam thing.
Well, why not? If it benefits the remaining captives and it's good for them, why isn't that good for the world? Why isn't that tikkun olam?
It doesn't say here that it's tikkun olam. The summary is that it's good only for them.
I know what it says, but why is that? Why is it not tikkun olam?
Because it's only for a very small amount of people, maybe 1, 2, 3.
Well, is it for the captives that are left behind, or is it for,
right.
So is there a time?
Right. So now he's gonna logic this out, and he's gonna tell you why he's mentioning specific captives, and he's gonna say that it's for these particular captives who are held captive at that time in that scenario.
So remain in captivity.
Exactly. So don't go break out, you know, in 1, 2, 3, 4, because it really helps these shivuyim, these captive souls who are there, in 2, 3, and 4, if you break one out. And that's going to be the difference that the Gemara brings to light in the way that the language works here. Let's now learn in the Gemara how that works out, whether or not they come to any conclusion. So the Mishnah teaches the captives can't be ransomed for more than their value. Into the Gemara. E bayalahu. So they ask the following question. Hai mitnei tikkun haolam. What do you make of this benefit of society? In what way is tikkun haolam really working out here when you teach us this Mishnah that you don't redeem them for their value? What's the inherent question? Well, is it really tikkun olam if I tell you don't pay a single dime more for your friend there? Is it really tikkun olam if your wife is held captive and I say only fair market value? An eved, one of your house folks who you really are connected to, you're not going to pay more? A fellow member of the community? So how is this tikkun olam? Mishum duchake de tziburahu. Does it mean that it's trying not to really burden the public, the community, tzibura? Does it mean that it's trying to not burden the community? It's not trying to push them too far? Duch kaka? It's not trying to push the community too far? Is that how it's tikkun olam? Meaning what?
To collect too much money.
To collect too much money.
If you're saying that everybody's equal and you're not to pay any more, in the way, and you're asked to pay more, then aren't you creating this, there could be some revenge or there could be some sort of retaliation by the other side, so you're defeating the whole purpose.
If you pay more, they will continue to capture more.
Well, that's a different issue than I think Aria is bringing up. Wait, so what do you mean, though? Aria, clarify what you mean.
A specific price. They know it's a person's wife. They know this is an important person in the community. They're asking for a higher amount than the local slave. And you are said here not to pay an equal amount causes...
Not to pay more than the regular value of that person.
What is the regular value? Because to certain people are worth a lot more.
See, that's the personal piece here that's mixed in. And if to you, you come to the community. Let's say the rest of the community is gathered. God forbid, your wife she's been taken captive. And you say, she's not worth 40 sela. She's worth 400,000. You've got to pay this. We've got to pay this. And you tell everybody around, and you really, really press them. If the law says that you're not allowed to press me into giving up my money for your beloved, the Gemara wants to know, is that what you mean by tikkun olam? That you can't pressure everybody else to put their money down on the table for your captive?
But that's from your end of it. I'm looking at it from the other side.
I know you're looking at it
from the other side.
That's being
asked for.
I realize that you're asking that question in terms of what's being asked for. Now, they might ask for anything that they please. So if I say, let's say I'm the captive, I say 500. Really, the price generally is 40 for a captive. Because I know, by the way, that you are so connected. By the way, I also know you're not the richest guy in town. So you're not going to come up with that money on your own. I'm going to throw that in now because we're going to get to a point here where people are going to throw their own money on the table for a second. But I know that you're going to have to go to the community. Shimon ben Gamliel knows you're going to have to go to the community to get that money if you really want to make this happen. Shimon ben Gamliel says, as hard as it is for me to tell the community that you really have no right to do that and they don't have to be burdened, is that what he means? Is that what Gamliel means? By the way, we don't know who the Tanna Kamma is. What's the Tanna Kamma? The first opinion in the Mishnah. We don't have a named Tanna when it says Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam, but we might assume that it's Shimon ben Gamliel since he's mentioned in the bottom of the Mishnah, or we might assume that it's Gamliel for the first one and then Shimon ben Gamliel in the second one because Shimon ben Gamliel and Gamliel are connected. We don't really know. But meanwhile, he's saying, you're not allowed. Or even if you ask, people are not hayav. People are not obligated to actually come up with that money. But is that tikkun olam?
We're not supposed to pay more than the value. Is value supposed to be something that's set out? There's a standard value?
Yeah, the way that the rabbis the way that the rabbis create value for people, Jew or non-Jew, is to think about that person's value on the human trafficking slave market, if you will, the servant's market. And it seems like what they do
what
is...
other people would pay for a similar person?
Right, with the similar physical abilities, with the similar status that they have, and if a person's a debtor...
So some kind of a...
No, because if you don't redeem him, they will sell him for slavery. So that's the value.
So there's a market value.
Yeah, there is a market value.
There's a market value. That's pretty much the assumption here. I mean, Ron's right, that they assume that person's going to be either taken as a slave... Or if it's a woman, that she's going to be married into.
Sold to as a woman.
Maybe not even sold. Maybe married into the community.
It would be some kind of exchange price.
But there is a market for human beings at the time that can be the place where you end value certain human beings. So that's the value. Or let me suggest a different way, because some people have thought about what it meant to have captives from a community where you're not really using the slave market. The theory goes that in, you know, all's fair in love and war, right, that certain people who are trying to basically snore people out of their money, you do the hard work and we'll steal it from you kind of attitudes, that they actually set a certain price, like a tax, almost. And so, you know, like, for some reason, I was reading today, the redemption price for Shvuyin, for those held captive in the caliphate, when there was really nasty kind of community relations happening between Jews and non-Jews, that was 33. But the Jewish people were willing to pay for it. That's what the documents in the Geniza reveal. That money was probably not based on any slave market or selling of human beings. That money was basically
to our community,
and a basic, almost seemed like some kind of tax or pressure to cough up some more money beyond the either taxes or what do you call those when you're bringing money to the king?
Tributes.
That you have to give to the royalty or the rulers around. So he's basically setting up a system where it might mean that even though they're asking for a big price, or you really want us to pay a bigger price, the community does not necessarily have to come up with that money. Now, O Dilma, the Gemara says, well, perhaps let me reason it this way. Maybe it has nothing to do with the kind of burden that would be put on the community. Mishum de lo ligravu valaitu tafe. Maybe it is a prohibition that was enacted so that these idolaters or these captive takers will not be encouraged to capture more people and create a whole system whereby they capture members of our community and just create a ransom system, a tribute system, a tax system, some type of system of snoring us
all the time. Yeah, like the Somalis.
So, right, so you have Ad Hayom Hazeh, till this very day, you have this issue in the world. Get to that in a second. Back in here. Here's the Gemara's question thus far, in terms of where we are. Is this tikkun olam so as not to draw you into conversation with your own community and for you to be upset, angry, disappointed, enraged that the community's funding will not be used for this, either personally in terms of your neighbors or communally if there's a communal purse? Or is this so that we stop the whole pirate ransom system to begin with? Now, does it have to be an or? You know, people always say when there's two sides of a question, well, you know, it's obviously and. We can answer that it's both and. So sometimes you have to ask yourself, when you initially have this reaction, of course it's both and, which one sounds more like the legal reasoning behind it, or which one is more effectuated by the law? And what can we learn about the tikkun olam approach to the law by identifying which one seems more likely the case? The Gemara wants to know that. Which one seems more likely? Or, I will give you rhetorically, is the Odilma, or perhaps saying, this is the way I'm going to be able to bring both arguments to the table, they both seem pretty much equally as good, and Tikkun Olam then has a double valence in this case. But how does it strike you? Does one sound more reasonable than another? Is it completely both? Is the rhetoric of the Gemara arguing it back and forth, you know, equating them and giving us two reasons? Or does one seem to speak to you more?
I think that it depends who is the person that was captured. Because if it will be the son of the rabbi of that community, I can assure you they will have the money even double. And if it will be somebody who was a slave of somebody who was the middle class or even a lower level, maybe they will help, maybe they will not. So I think it's very important who was the person that was captive.
Hmm. So as the law applies to various individuals, let's push this forward a little bit, Ron. Let's say it was that Hashuva person that was an important person. At some point, the community might be able to fall back on this law, though, and say, for sure, we might have the money. But the law says that we really don't go this extra mile.
So there's a very good analogy that all of us can remember. So remember when, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name.
Gilad Shalit.
No. John F. Kennedy's son, with his new wife, took off in a plane in an airplane, airstorm.
Yeah.
A very unexperienced
pilot.
Yeah. What did the United States do?
Nothing.
We spent a fortune to try to find them.
Yeah, but they would do it anyhow.
I disagree with you. Do you think they would have done it for your
Look what they did. Look what they
I
are
don't.
Doing.
The Coast Guard is always...
The Coast Guard, the
you
budget...
You don't think they did an exceptional amount because it was whatever his name is?
I don't know.
The Coast Guard has his budget. They do it anyhow.
I don't remember.
It wasn't John F. Jr.
It was John F. Jr. I couldn't remember his name.
Yeah.
I think they went to no holds bars. Cost millions and millions of dollars.
I don't remember what they did.
I think
they did way beyond what would have done for a local person. That's my
maybe you think so because as long as they think that the people are alive, the efforts are duplicate or triplicate. But the minute after 48 hours to 72 hours, then they reduce it to normal. But at the beginning, it's very high RPM to look for them. But we have the story of Gilad Shalit, and there is a law in many countries that the law used to be that countries don't pay ransom for kidnapped. Now they change it in many places that the family allowed to raise money as private to help their...
But not here.
No, even in the United States.
No, you're not.
We moved towards it.
Yeah, even in the United States. But as a state, we are not doing so. But the family...
It's soft here. You can do it.
The family can raise the money, and if they want to do it privately, that's fine. But the state will not obey the demands. So there is like two steps or two ways to approach it.
I'm not sure that that's...
That's then...
I'm not sure. If you say so, I'm not familiar with the law, but...
It's very new, the whole
issue. Getting back to this, it seems to me that discouraging the capture of more people is more beneficial universally. And that would be the tikkun olam that I would, that would be the tikkun olam.
Yeah, if you're talking systemically, right? The fact that we could so personalize the case where someone so precious to our haver, our friend, and we could fall back on this law. It seems like, okay, a very individualized case and not the olam. And if you're going to use this principle of tikkun olam and take the word olam seriously, as in the larger than just us kind of neighborhood, then I would agree on its face that it can create the system whereby the world seems to work a little bit better where you don't have a bunch of pirates thinking that they can take everybody's neighbors and community by community soak them dry. Right? So that seems to me as well to be somewhat of the Odilma and the or perhaps law reasoning comes into play a little bit more than the individualized case. He says the Gemara is going to go back to the individualized case.
I was going to say, you could certainly extrapolate from that a benefit to the community.
Right.
There's no question, because you prevent people from going bankrupt, or the community from going bankrupt.
Right, and that is, in and of itself, economically,
and it does discourage,
the goal of the legal system.
And it discourages kidnapping beyond that, because
right.
you're not going to get any money.
So it could very well be that you always see Odilma as a both and you can find the, or perhaps it's this, not asking you for, you know, does this work better, but how do these both come to light? The Gemara wants to know, in terms of one specific case, what are we really going to say about this when someone takes from his own resources and really puts a lot more down? If the Mishnah said ein podin es ashvuyin yater al kedei d'mehen, if the Mishnah says you don't pay any extra in terms of what they're worth, in terms of their value, what do I do with this case? Tashma, come here. Now, Tashma always introduces kind of a case that was. There was a case.
Come listen.
Come hear this. Oh, you said that? I'll tell you something. Tashma. De Levi Bar Darga, Parka Levarte Bitlesar Alfe Dinare Zahav. Levi, the son of Darga, ransomed his daughter for 13,000 golden dinars. Now that's way beyond,
even today,
way beyond what the quote-unquote value for his daughter was. And if you say that the prohibition was enacted to prevent the financial burden on the community,
it was private money.
Ah, so you have to answer that maybe it was private money, and maybe therefore I don't say that it was community money, and it still really is. The reason that I don't put a burden on the community could still be the reason, even though you have this Levi, son of Darga story. Well, Abaye comes and chimes in and says the following. I'm our Abaye. Uman lemalan, but who can say to us, devritzon chachamim avad, that Levi acted with the permission or the consent of the chachamim? Who says that Levi went out and acted according to Jewish law? Maybe he went out and just did his own thing despite what the sages legislated. Maybe he didn't listen a lick. Period. You might have thought some kind of resolution to that question was coming. Gemara's going to leave it there. Listen again now with my finishing it off in that sense. Maybe he didn't act according to legislation at all.
What he wanted to do.
And he acted completely and entirely without any permission of Jewish law and what the sages legislate. So I find this to be an absolute reduction to reality. Right? I'm going to call that a reduction to reality. What's the reality? I'll give you one sense of that reality. The law says nobody should make a lavish bar bat mitzvah for their child in the Jewish day school. No lavish bar bat mitzvah. Everybody's going to spend up to and including, let's say, $12,000. You make a kiddush and everybody gives a little teeny gift in a day school of 87 kids. Well, guess what? Everybody can sign that agreement. But there are a couple families who are going to spend $100,000 on some incredible lavish affair. And it kind of shakes up the rest of the community thinking, am I doing right by my kid?
Do we have that agreement?
No. Nothing like it. Nothing like it. By the way, Rabbanim in Brooklyn, in the Orthodox community, a few years back, this is early 2000s, saw people spending so much on weddings that they actually created a takana. They made a decree that spending, you know, X percent of your income, or if you had to borrow, it is asur, forbidden, and no one should feel as though their wedding wasn't as holy and special and beautiful and great if people overspend. And this came out from a group of rabbis and then was picked up by different communities in order to try to convince the Jewish community to not try to outdo one the next.
Yeah, but
when it came to affairs.
But when the chief rabbi, his daughter got married, there was 10,000 guests, and it was such a lavish, and they gave money to each participant who came to be,
Lahavdil. When you have
that's
the chief,
in conflict to what they justified.
But that's not the, first of all, it's not the chief rabbi of Israel.
Oh, not of Israel, the chief rabbi of that community there.
Well, you don't, that community, which one? I mean, if you're talking about one of the Hasidic communities, and they wanted to use some of their funds for New Square, let's say, or for this or that community, that's not who I'm talking about. I'm talking about a specific group of rabbis within the... It came out of Brooklyn, and I don't know which ones, you know, exactly said this. I'm giving you one example of what a few chachamim could say in order to try to create a tikkun olam approach. And that is tikkun olam, let's say, versus and in contradistinction to what tikkun olam is defined as in some other circles of Judaism, where it might be you know, anything from environmentalism to hunger relief. Tikkun olam may indeed take the shape of what our Gemara says when authorities, the sages, try to get to some equitable sense of how Jews spend their money. And that's a very different kind of tikkun olam than how that phrase is used in everyday Jewish parlance in modern Jewish times.
It is an attempt to try to deal with a vast difference in the ability to pay.
Right.
Whether it's successful or not, but at least it's an attempt.
Right.
So it does. It is evidence of an attention to certain values.
Yeah. And I think that's wonderful. I think this is a wonderful recapturing of the roots of this principle that at its core sounds so inviting for the Jewish community of modern times, and that it's another element of how Tikkun Olam can capture the hearts of the Jewish world and capture the hearts of the Jewish community.
Why is the foundation of democracy or democratic approach to things, try to equalize, make everybody pull the weight and fully in some way? It's not directly, but...
I mean, I hear the direction you're suggesting.
Indirectly.
Very
fundamentally, it's an approach.
Let's put it this way. I don't know if it's the core of democracy, but it is... You could argue in some way that it is part of the greatest hopes within a free market society, or, frankly, the socialists could argue with the same principle and say it's part of the greatest hopes of socialism. So I think that for political motives, you could use the principle in an expeditious way, whether you were coming at it from any number of systems approaches.
Probably the word socialism is better than democracy. Yeah.
And so the question is, though, is economic justice, in whatever way we want to just frame economic justice, or at least attention to some degree of how much one has to spend on any aspect of one's life, you know, in which system is that hope that everybody will have what they need expressed the most, and that can be argued in the world.
It's
but
called communism.
Everybody can use it for their own sense, but tikkun olam for the sages was, we have whatever kind of market economy that existed within the world of ancient classical Judaism. We want people to have and keep hold of their funding, We don't want to empower communities or individuals within their communities, in this case particularly, to use up all the money to ransom captives. We want to give them some type of shield when it comes to overpaying, and we want to discourage the people who commit these crimes. So all in all, it's sounding good, and it's getting us to a place of being aware that some people have more than others, because when you tell the story of Levi's Ben Darga, who can go take his fortune and pay whatever the asking price is, and that he would do so without any sanction from the Chachamim, potentially what they're doing is they're pointing to a problem that still exists within the world. And that problem that still exists is that there will be a group who will say, well, we'll take advantage of those that have enough of the funds. And, you know, this is the fodder of great Hollywood movies. You kidnap the so-and-so of the family who just won the lottery, or the wealthy family who lives over there, and they get all the authorities involved, and they have to talk through what's the right thing to do, and how much ransom should I pay, and are we really going to pay these millions, and all these things. You know, the whole story is coming to light here. You know, who set it up, and did he go to the sages at first, and did he go to the community and say, am I going to do this? You could make for really interesting script writing in here, just from going from our first paragraph of, you know, when they really reasoned and logic'd this law out, to this moment where Levi Ben Darga has this big dilemma and has to figure out if he's going to bring them the gold, right?
Would they use a different word for captive if it was in the context of a conflict? You know, like a military conflict?
Same
word or a different word?
They would use the same word. They would use the same word.
And we would know from the context? Or?
And exactly.
Okay.
Or some commentator might try to figure out whether or not we're talking about a wartime or not.
Because the left behind part is interesting.
So good. So there, you're on to something. Commentators will try to pick out from our story, what is the context here? Are we talking about a time of war? Are we talking about a time of the Roman Empire crushing the Jewish people? Are we talking about a time where it seems relatively peaceful, and the law then can be applied to our relatively peaceful times? So that will come into play as sages, both from, well, more so from time beyond this, try to look back and see what they can make of any of the language and any of the scenario. We'll get to one. Okay? We'll get to one. It'll come to life. Actually, let's look at it. Okay, so the way that we'll look at it is that the way we'll look at it is we're gonna look at, first of all, Rashi and then a Tosafot, just to clarify what we've learned thus far. No, we're gonna look at just the Tosafot. Left hand side of the page, up at the top of the page. Delo ligrabu velaitu. Okay? So maybe it's so that we won't encourage more people, more pirates, more bandits, to capture more people. Okay, the Tosafot, delo ligrabu velaitu. See it up there?
I have it done, yeah.
You got it, Smeir? Want to follow along?
Yeah, I have it.
You have it. Okay. Ready? So the Tosafot are collectively in the generation of Rashi's grandchildren and authorities who are going to really try to help us synthesize the material that's found not only on our page in the Gemara, but elsewhere in the Gemara. That's the job of the Tosafot. And when it comes to law sometimes, they're going to bring to light some differences in the law that exist in other sugyas in the Talmud. Oh, how could I say over here, for instance, that the law is you don't pay more than the value of somebody, if I know a law over there that says there's no limit on what a person can pay for himself to redeem himself. In other words, if you're captured and you're a wealthy guy and you say, listen, I'll give you $1 million if you let me go. So the Tosfot are going to do this. All right, inside the Tosfot. V'haditanya. So we see that there's a brayta, because remember the word Tanya is a brayta. V'haditanya b'perek na'ara. Here's the way the question works. Don't we have a brayta in the chapter over there in Masechet Ketubot, in the Gemara in Ketubot, marriage contracts? Don't we have a brayta, a teaching over there in Ketubot? Nishbet v'hayu mevakshin mimena ad asara bedame pam rishon pode. Don't we have the teaching in Ketubot, in a brayta, a very authoritative text, time of the Mishnah, that if she's captured, nishbet, and they were requesting on her head, the price they put on her head is up to 10 times the value, ba'asara bedame, pamrishon pode. Then once they, the first time they ask, you are allowed to redeem. So the Tosfot is saying, wait a minute, you're telling me there's a law, Tikkun Olam, that you can't pay more than value? Well, here they're asking 10 times, and you're getting permission. Shane Ishto. The answer the Tosfot come up with is that it's different, because here we're talking about his wife. Dehave Kegufo. Yoter Mibito. Because here we're talking about his wife and not his daughter. So the obvious first case in the Mishnah must have been that we were talking about a wife. No, says the Tosfot. The obvious case in our Mishnah is that we were talking about his daughter. Because the Ketubah Gemara is talking about his wife. And in the Ketubah Gemara, if they ask for 10 times the value of the wife, I'm allowed to redeem her. So I learn over here in my Mishnah that it must have been talking not about a wife, but about the daughter. And what's my clue that the whole Mishnah might be talking about a daughter? That I have the story of who?
Levi
ben Darga. So if Levi ben Darga was talking about his daughter and paid up to 13,000 gold dinars, then the Tosafot, I believe, are saying, I see the Mishnah here is also talking about someone's daughter and not about the wife. Again, because if we were talking about the wife, I would rely on the Brayta in Ketubot that said if they asked for 10 times the amount, you could pay. Dehacha, and here also, wait a minute, I also have another question to bring up. Va'al atzmo lo tiknu shelo yiten kol asher lo ba'ad nafsho. And also, wait a minute, don't I say about an individual who's taken captive that that individual is able to pay up to any amount that he wants to redeem himself? For Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya, deparke lahahu tinok b'mamon harbe b'hanizkin. And I also have to think about the case that's going to come up later in my own Masechta, in Gittin, in our Talmud, not in our volume from our scroll, but in this Talmud, Masechta, in Gittin, that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya was dealing with a case where someone was taken captive. It was a tinok. It was a youngster. And that youngster, and we say it's a youngster and not a baby, by the way, because you could say a tinok is a baby. No, no. We're talking about a youth, a tinok, because the story that's told later on in our Gemara down the line in the 50s, mentions the page, Daf Nunchet Aleph, 58a, he's walking and he goes into a place where there are captives, and he says the beginning of a verse, and this tinok, this youth, finishes the verse from our holy scriptures. And he knows immediately that in fact this is a youth worth saving. And that I may be even obligated to pay more than the value of this youth, because one day he will be a great chacham. One day he will be a great one among the sages. And in fact, that individual who redeemed this child for a large amount of money on 58A ultimately sees that this youngster becomes a great Rav. So the whole Masechta is in one volume in the Steinfeld version. And the story goes like this. What's that?
Huge story here. On
yeah,
page.
It's a huge story.
It's huge.
The sage is taught in a braita, and this is in Horayot. Listen, it deals with our inyan, it deals with our issue, our topic. The sages deal with it, and this is Maaseh b'Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya. There was an incident involving Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya. Shehalach lichrach gadol sheberomi. He once went to the great city of Rome. And they said to him, Amrulo, tinok echad yesh beveit ha'asurim. We have this tinok in the jail. There's a child in prison. Yafei enayim v'tov roi. He has beautiful eyes and an attractive appearance. Ukvutzo tav sidurot lo taltalim. And he has curly, beautiful locks of hair. Now you tell me why they talk about his appearance over here. I'm not really sure. But keep it in mind as a question. Rabbi Yoshua, halach Rabbi Yoshua, v'amad al petach beit ha'asurim. He goes and he stands at the entrance to the prison. Amar, he says, Mi natan limshisa Yaakov v'Yisrael li vozazim. He says, who gave Jacob for a spoil and Israel to the robbers? That's Isaiah 42:24. Ana oto tinok v'amar. The child answered him and said, want to know who gave us over? Halo Hashem zo chatanu lo, v'lo avu vidrachav haloch, v'lo shamu b'sorato. Did not the Lord, he against whom we have sinned, and in whose ways they would not walk, neither were they obedient to his law. So he finishes the verse. Amar, Rabbi Yoshua, says the following, Muv tachni bo, shemorei hora'a b'Yisrael, that this child will become a great sage among all Israel. Ha'avodah, he will make rulings, and by the work of the temple, she'eini zaz mikan, I am not moving from this city. Ad she efedenu b'chol mamon sheposkin alav. I am not leaving this city until I redeem him with any amount of money it takes. Amru, they said, lo zaz misham ad she pida'o b'mamon harbe. He didn't leave the city until they just created a massive ransom. Gathered a massive ransom to pay. Below Hayu Yamim Muatin Ad Shehora Hora Abi Israel. And not even a few days passed, and the child issued great halachic rulings and teachings in Israel. Umanu, and who was that child? Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha. Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha. So, the Tosafot know this story in our Masechta, just like they know the other Gemara that we had in Ketubot, and the situation of the halachic ruling about a person redeeming himself. So, we get from the Tosafot three different lessons and a clarification about the potential case that our Mishnah is dealing with. Three clarifications. If it's your wife and they ask for 10 times the amount, you can pay. If you're captured yourself and you have to promise all the money in the world, no limits on what you can promise. Three, based on the story of Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, there's a captive who's got beautiful eyes and rich curls and can finish your Torah verses, and you suspect that that child will become a sage in all Israel, any amount of money in the world. And you don't leave Rome without it.
Yeah.
And finally, the clarification on the Mishnah, and that is, maybe I need to learn from Levi ben Darga that I'm really talking about a daughter, and I'm not talking about a wife or a slave. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, but there is the Tikkun Olam story has nothing to do with it completely. It's all private cases. The rule of law, the Jewish rule of law, doesn't obey. It's not implemented in any of the cases.
No, so let's talk about that, because that's the reduction to reality that's happening, that I told you I came up with this kind of way of thinking about this Gemara. I want to call this great Tikkun Olam, lots of economic justice at the core, but also a reduction to Jewish reality. What is the reduction to Jewish reality over here?
Everyone is doing whatever they want.
And the rabbis know it.
You can do it, Trump. You use your own money. You can do Hillary, take it from Wall Street, and you can do Bernie, take it dollar by dollar.
I don't know about it. What's the analog today? But I do know that what the rabbis are saying.
You have to call around there, because what's the right way to do politics?
I don't even want to know. But what I do want to know is how they're so keyed into the Jewish sensibility of Levi ben Darga, okay, who says, you made a law, okay.
Got gezoekt.
Exactly. Right? I mean, and it's so prevalent in today's world. Now, the opposite is the roboticism of a world where everybody goes according to what the Rebbe says. And so, you know, the opposite end of the spectrum is not necessarily an expression of the free will, like we sometimes want to think about, that we were granted and we were given and we should choose to do this, chai behem, and live through them, and find some level of real justice and apply these values in order to create a society filled with justice. Okay, so I can see that there's a middle ground, and I would hope that halacha would actually move more and more and more towards actually the expression that's found within the major principle of law here, which is, for me, back to the Mishnah, Tikkun Olam. The Mishnah is trying to get there. The Odilma, the original argument about asking how this benefits society, is really at the core of the approach that we're taking, with the recognition that we're dealing with individual human beings in individual cases. It's a very fascinating reality check at the same time that it's aspirational. Right? That's what I find it to be really fascinating that way. So fascinating that way. Okay. Let's push on a little bit with the Gemara on this Mishnah. See where else it goes. Because we have this whole other aspect of the Mishnah, and that is that the Ein Mavrichin et Hashvui, you can't help the captives escape. The Ein Mavrichin et Hashvui mivnei tikkun haolam. you can't help the captives escape. This prohibition is enacted for what? Originally, Tikkun Olam, and Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer Mipnei Takanat Shvuyin. But Rabban ben Gamliel says, let me give you a different category for this. It's for the benefit of any captives who are left behind. The Gemara is now going to define the practical difference between the views of the Tanakhama that says Tikkun Olam, the Tanakhama of the Seifa of the Mishnah. The second part of the Mishnah is called, in this case, the Seifa. You have a Tanakhama in the Seifa because you have a different situation where you're talking about helping captives now. So you have a Tanakhama's opinion that says it's Tikkun Olam, and the Tanabatra, and the last Tana, that says it's Takanat Shvuyin. And who is the Tana Batra? We know. Shimon ben Gamliel. We know who the last Tana is. We don't know who the first one is. Okay. So he says, what's the difference? My Benayu. What's the real difference? Is there any difference really here? Let's talk about what the difference is. Ika Benayu. No, I'll tell you, there is some difference. There is some difference. Deleika elachad. It's the difference is that one is talking about a case where you have only one person held captive, and the other one is talking about a case where you have multiple people being held captive. As we were saying before, it's not new for us. We anticipated it, but that's the real difference the Gemara wants to bring out. The Tanakhama holds it was enacted for the all members of society, but those who were currently held captive and those who might be taken in the future. Whereas Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, no, this is a particular law for the time when what?
Current situation.
It's a what?
Current situation.
It's a current situation where, do you have more than one captive? Yes.
Yeah. At the same time.
And so I can't help one of them, because what's going to happen to the other ones?
They will suffer.
They'll suffer.
They will pay the price.
They'll suffer. So if I come and break you out of jail, but your three buddies are there, boy, are they going to be examples now for everybody else who might get this help. Rashi says, Deleika elechad, and he says, Shema yichtzfu al ha-shivuyim ha-atidim lavo v'idnum b'shal shalot u'v'chritzim. They're going to use chains and they're going to use balls around their neck, and they're going to really not just hold them in a cell and let them sit like human beings. They're literally going to encumber them and chain them up and do everything they can to keep you from actually breaking them out of their jails, to breaking them out of their dungeons. And that will be terrible. That will be terrible. And particularly when they're around, Shimon ben Gamliel is worried, and in general, it's going to be really hard for those in the future, according to the Tanakhama. Okay, so they just want to show you that there's a difference between the two of them. In the case of one person held captive, what do you think Shimon ben Gamliel would say? Would he allow the help, or would he agree with the Tanakhama and say, you know what, I'll go with your svara too, I'll go with your thinking too, it will be terrible for people in the future, I'm even going to accede to your sensibility?
If there is only one, he will allow to do that.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think that the fact that he has a very different opinion, and that he points out a case that it's worth talking about multiples here, because of the current situation. Now that's meaningful legally. I'm asking you a question that's meaningful legally.
But it would also be okay then to get everybody out, as long as you don't leave anybody.
Well, yeah, I think that he would say that. He said, if you really could get everybody out, I probably would agree with that, except that he might be so worried that he would say, don't send the rescue party in. Like, don't send the chopper in to just break six of them out of the compound. Because then the 20 who are left, right? Can you really guarantee me, Commander, that you're going to break out all 26?
Yeah. Well, if you're going to do it, you think you're
going to. But it still has an adverse effect on future captives.
It might. But the legal difference here, or effectively, I don't know if it's a legal difference or it's the result of the application of the law, is that what they're suggesting between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is you have to figure out whether or not you're going to take that risk in terms of future captives. When they're really there and they're being held captive, I'm worried enough to tell you, don't go just break one of them out. By the way, what's an argument that says I really should break one of those guys out, even if there are 5 or 10 or 15 left?
It depends who is this person that you want to...
Okay, it might depend on the person, him or herself.
Yeah, but I don't think that nowadays they will...
If you save one life,
there's hope.
You save the world, right?
So wait a minute.
Risk the other.
So I have that note written right over here, Arthur. Someone's going to bring up the Mishnah, because that's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Save one, it's like saving a world. Right?
Yeah, but you risk all the others.
So I might halachically find somebody to argue that by saving simply one person. Now, where that is more the case in Jewish legal parlance is where someone's coming around, like the team of...
If you know everyone's going to die, then you want to save one.
Okay, so that's another one of the times that the argument for that is used. If you really know someone, everybody's going to die, and right now, you know, it's me or nobody, and I somehow got that message out to folks, and they helped me break out, because everybody's really going to get it. Go back one step, though, where we don't know everybody's going to die, and let's say that we live in a town in Russia at the time that we were avoiding the draft, and I know that I can receive the help of these two or those three friends of mine after they've rounded up the 9 of us. Am I allowed to tell them, go now? So what's interesting is that I've been doing a little bit of the reading towards our Gemara. I found a case or two where they allowed at that moment someone, even though it might really, really adversely affect the 8 other soldiers or soldiers-to-be or fellow neighbors who are being put into kind of grunt jobs that maybe weren't soldier jobs even, but were even worse service to the country, and you're separated from your family for longer than just the typical out to the battlefront kind of scene. But there are a few who really said, like, if it needs to be done, it needs to be done. You take care of it. Because there's no telling whether or not you're going off to die without ever being freed back to your family and community. Ad kedei kach, that level of concern in terms of what we had to face. One person made a comment, an interesting comment in terms of the who it was. I'm not sure if you were saying this or another element of the who it was, that if I can free someone and I can learn quickly what the inside of the compound looks like and where the potential routes are and how to actually effectively make this operation a success, that perhaps I could trump, if this was the law that I was going with, perhaps I could trump this law, get that one captive, and then go back. As long as I had in mind the operation to free the rest of my people and not decide, oh, well, it seems too dangerous. So that was one of those discussions that rolled off from here. We said the issue is alive today. So... April 1st, 2016, not very long ago, Hamas leaders admitted that they have 4 Israelis currently, right? You know this news? So there are 2 Israelis being held who are alive, one who is Israeli, one who is Bedouin Israeli, and there are 2 bodies of 2 soldiers that they revealed that they have. because in the history of redeeming captives in modern times, we have both redeemed for people who are alive, and we've redeemed
the bodies.
For the bodies of those who are...
Yeah, but you know, the Bedouin, that they say, they don't know if he really maybe went there on his own. They don't... it's not so clear about that specific
thing. There is some controversy, but right, Hamas definitely wants to take...
I understand the statement, but
yeah,
it's...
Yeah. Here's the history. This is written by Professor Rabbi David Galinkin of the Schechter Institutes, who's not writing in 2016, but wrote this in 2003. I just thought it would be very interesting to hear about our issue, our topic here, in light of what he was commenting upon. So he says, in 2003, for the past few months, Israelis and the Israeli media have been conducting a fierce debate on the subject of Pidyon Shvuyim, the redemption of captives. Should Israel exchange 400 Arab terrorists, including Sheikh Obed and Mustafa Dirani, for Elchanan Tannenbaum and the bodies of three Israeli soldiers kidnapped and killed in Lebanon in October 2000? This has been further complicated by the fact that this exchange will not include Lieutenant Colonel Ron Arad, who was captured in Lebanon 17 years ago, nor information about his fate, even though Obed and Dirani were captured by Israel for the express purpose of exchanging them for Ron Arad. Indeed, this is not the first time Israel has debated a lopsided prisoner exchange. There follows a chart comparing similar exchanges in the past. 6-day war, 4 Israelis exchanged for 6,000 soldiers. Yom Kippur War, 294 Israelis, 8,400 soldiers. November 1983, 6 Israelis for 4,500 Lebanese and 99 terrorists held in Israeli jails. And May 1985, 3 Israelis, 1,150 on terrorism charges. The first two exchanges were with Arab countries and were part of the ceasefire agreement after the war. In the last case, there was no ceasefire. 800 of the 1,150 terrorists were returned to the West Bank, where many resumed terrorist activity. Arguments in favor of the current exchange, he goes on to list them. Israel has a moral obligation to do whatever it takes to redeem its citizens. A bird in hand is worth two in the bush. Better to save Elchanan Tannenbaum now, since no one knows the fate of Ron Arad. Tannenbaum has been tortured and is sick. We must save him now because he's in immediate danger. Four, Israel must do everything it can to redeem captives like Tannenbaum, because if not, our soldiers will retreat in battle rather than risk capture. And five, most of the 400 terrorists to be released do not have blood on their hands. Arguments against the current exchange. Israel should not redeem captives at any price. If terrorists know that they will always be freed, Israel loses its power of deterrence. Two, this exchange is a betrayal of Ron Arad. Obed and Dirani were captured in order to exchange them for Ron Arad. They should not be released until Iran discloses information about Arad. Three, many have emphasized that Tannenbaum was captured in Abu Dhabi, where he flew in order to buy drugs or engage in criminal activity. Israel should not release terrorists in order to redeem a criminal. Four, exchanging hundreds of terrorists for one Israeli encourages future kidnappings of Israelis. Five, there's no such thing as a harmless terrorist. It would put the community in danger. And six, it might give prestige to the organizations who are in the negotiating seats. He goes then on to describe Pidyon Shvuyim in rabbinic literature, which indeed says that in Baba Batra is where we first get the mitzvah rabbah status for Pidyon Shvuyim. It is a great mitzvah in order to redeem captives. And he mentions that our Gemara, when the price is too high, our Mishnah and Gemara, comes to really inform us one does not ransom captives for more than their value because of tikkun olam, literally fixing the world. For the good order of the world is how he further translates that, as a precaution for the general good. And one does not help captives escape because of tikkun olam. Interestingly, it doesn't quote Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, but stops it there. The Mishnah was codified by the standard codes of Jewish law, and their debate is between whether it's a burden on the community financially, or that the robbers should not seize more captives. The Talmud does not decide which explanation is correct, so halakhic authorities throughout the ages had an open door to express their opinions on whether or not the situations that arose deserved a ruling in one way or another. So that what we see here, and what I'm interested in, is of course the issues themselves, but I'm also interested in Rabbi Galinkin's read of the Gemara.
Yeah, but there is a major difference between what the rabbi say and
say how I see Rabbi Galinkin's read of the Gemara, and that is, the Gemara's rhetorical position is that, A, you're going to be dealing with the redeeming of captives and ransoming captives the entire course of your history, Jewish people. B, sometimes you're going to have to invoke the law to say it's too much of a burden on the community for you to pay this price. And alternatively, there's going to be a time where you really have to figure out whether the issue is about stopping groups who seize your own and holding them captive and trying to create a different kind of playing field, if you will, with those who would be pirates in this regard. So I think that he has an interesting take on the rhetoric of our passages. And that's where I just want to leave it for a second. You had a comment, and then Alex said something?
At that time, in the Talmud time, or when the Talmud wrote what we discussed, we were not in power of our community. So we could never set up to capture the bandit and bring them to justice. Nowadays, Israel is a sovereignty with the power to bring those people to justice if we want, and we do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason he left it open, because we couldn't do it at that time. We were underdog. We were always under, the police wasn't Jewish police. We were afraid of that police or whatever was in that time, whoever in control where we lived. In diaspora, or even in Israel. And nowadays it's different. And nowadays, we have the ability to go after those people. And that's what we do, and that's basically the fight now, that we run after them, and they... It's like climbing a ladder.
I think he's saying that there's a rule we can fall back on, a clear demarcation of what we should consider, but that it's always situational. And we have the ability, and not just the ability, not just because we can, but
we have an obligation to go after, and God, the United States and Israel and other countries are doing it all the time.
Well, but I think we have authority to act or not to act.
Right.
And that it's we have to make the moral decision.
Right.
Each time.
Right. And it's not a comfortable place to be. But it is the reality. With the power we have or not, one has to decide at what point there is either that entirety of power rests or lies in our hands, or it really doesn't. And that's a matter of conversation. But what I want to go back to is the end of the Tosfot for a second, because I didn't read you the very last phrase. And the very last phrase of the Tosafot after the whole story in Rome says the following, after he gets done explaining to us the Tosafot, that, child was extremely learned and therefore he was an exception to the rule. Here's what it says. The O Dilma of the Tosafot, the or perhaps it's like this, of the Tosafot is the phrase Inami, or perhaps, let me give you another way to think about what happened at that time when he was in Rome and pulled that kid out of the jail, right? Bishat Horban Abayit Lo Shayach Velo Ligvaru. At the very hour that Rome has troops amassed and they're destroying our temple, nobody's going to stop Yehoshua ben Hananya from collecting as much money as he possibly can to get this Jewish kid out of jail. And we're not going to talk to anybody about, you know, stopping to collect all that they possibly can, or bringing to bear all his wealth and riches to really make sure that this kid gets saved at a time when we are under attack. And we are experiencing Horban HaBayit. We are experiencing a time where the temple is destroyed. Now, cosmically, and, you know, if you will, spiritually, are we at the time where there is no more temple? Despite our seeming power, the question is whether or not we are at still an hour of Horban HaBayit in a spiritual way, in a even physical way. And so that's for different people to decide whether or not they want to apply the sense that we do or we don't have the power. But the openness that the Gemara provides for that debate, the richness of that debate, is really pretty incredible. And what do you think Rabbi Galinkin said? He said, the government didn't ask me. Yeah. But from a rabbinic perspective, since in practice, Levi ben Darga redeemed his daughter for 13,000 gold dinars, and since there seems to be a line of thinking throughout history that you could pay a little bit more, 40 versus 33 in the Geniza, and Rabbi David ben Zimra, the Radbaz, says you're in a situation where there's lots of battling going on and lots of contentious reality about whether or not we belong here, you always have to pay with a little bit more, and we value life, and we're going to pay the price, and should we do it? According to him, I'll read you his last piece. I was not asked by the Israeli government for my opinion, but if I were asked, I would have to reluctantly agree with the majority of Israeli rabbis who have written on the subject. I'm certainly in favor of halachic innovation, as advocated by Rabbi Halevi and others, but I think he's missing the plain meaning of the Mishnah. We do not pay excessive ransom, mipnei tikkun olam, for the public good. In other words, the public takes precedence over the individual, even if this endangers the individual. Exchanging hundreds or thousands of terrorists for one Israeli encourages kidnapping of Israelis and frees hundreds of thousands of terrorists who will pick up their weapons and attack Israel. In other words, if there's a danger to the greater public, it should not be done. And that was Rabbi Galinkin's piece from Schechter Institutes when he wrote it in 2003, based a lot in our Gemaras, and people opine in different ways, of course. And you've seen deals done in different ways, but that was at least one person really trying to apply sources from our sages to a modern situation.
And weren't there choices like that made in the Holocaust every day? You know? Warsaw Ghetto.
Definitely. Definitely. Not easy issues and never easy answers.